Hi, my name is Danielle, and you're listening to Crime and Mystery Canada. On this podcast, we discuss subjects that might be creepy to some, and sometimes even frightening. Some of our episodes will deal with serious subject matter, while others will be more lighthearted. Please keep in mind that I am not an expert on any of the topics I cover, just an interested party, and as always, listener discretion is advised. Hi everyone and welcome back. I'm Danielle and I'm here with Paul Emile.
Hi.
And you're listening to Crime and Mystery Canada. On tonight's episode, we'll be discussing Montreal's Night of Terror. Ever heard of it?
Does not ring a bell.
I actually came across the event while I was doing some research on another case, and I hadn't heard about it either. I did think it was something interesting to talk about, so I thought I'd shed a little light on what happened in Montreal. This was back in 1969.
Wow, sounds a little spooky.
The events are known under two different names. Some people call it Montreal's Night of Terror, but it's also known as the Murray Hill Riots. If you've ever watched the movie The Purge, you might understand a little bit more about how those events unfolded. It does remind me a little bit of that film where everything just kind of turns to chaos and mayhem for one night.
It sounds like recent events.
A little bit, yeah. There's some stuff that feels quite familiar with kind of how things unraveled, not really the situation that set them off. We're going to start with a little bit of historical context that can explain some of the tension that was happening in Montreal around that time. There was a lot happening in Quebec in the 60s and 70s. I mean, there was a lot going on around the world in general, but in Quebec, in Montreal, it was no different. Up until the 1960s, the Roman Catholic Church had run most of the province's organization, like the healthcare system and their education system. So you went to school to a Catholic school, right? School was run by the church?
Yeah, the first, actually, from kindergarten and right up until grade three, it was a Catholic school that was, the teachers were nuns and brothers,
right.
Christian brothers.
Right. Yeah, I'm assuming New Brunswick was probably more or less similar with Quebec, where the church was kind of in charge of a lot more than what we see today.
I think one of the big differences with New Brunswick was that at that time, the only way you could get an education in French is if you went to a Catholic school. All the rest was in English.
Right. Around this time, around the whole world, things were changing. Some people were looking to have the church and government as two separate entities, not involved in one another's business. When the new government was elected in Quebec in the 60s, they decided it was time to make this change. The government wanted to take charge of these institutions and take them away from the church. This period was known as La Révolution Tranquille, or the Quiet Revolution. On top of that, there was a lot of unrest, a lot of fighting amongst the French-speaking Quebecois and the English-speaking Quebecois, which ultimately led to a kidnapping in the 1970s. That kidnapping happened shortly after the events that we're going to discuss tonight. Also, we're definitely going to have to cover that in one of our episodes because I think it's the second time it's come up.
Yes, and recently, I think a couple of weeks ago, one of the kidnapping victims passed away.
Oh, really? I didn't know that.
Yes. I can't remember his name right now, but it was just a couple of weeks ago.
So lots of changes happening in Quebec, in North America in general. There was a recession going on as well. According to the book Wish You Were Here by John Allore and Patricia Pearson, because of the recession, wage rollbacks began happening with the Quebec Federation of Policemen, which was the force policing Montreal at that time. The men in uniform did not take the idea of a wage rollback very well.
Well, I can imagine it's not an easy program to sell.
Right. I think most of us, if we were told that we were going to get a pay cut without actually changing anything to our job, I don't think any of us would take that very well. Also, to their defense, they were dealing with a lot of civil unrest, Hostage takings, bank robberies, bomb threats, demonstrations, all of that was going on a regular basis in the province. They actually felt that they were entitled to a wage increase. They wanted the same salary as the police officers in Toronto were getting because they felt that they were working in similar conditions.
Well, I think if you look at the size of both cities, they probably were right.
They may even have been dealing with a little bit more because of that dispute between the French and English-speaking people in the province. It was causing a lot of conflict. The city did agree to give them a raise, according to the Wikipedia article about the Murray Hill riots, but that raise fell short of the amount that they had been requesting. Because they weren't getting what they'd asked for, they decided to strike. I saw that this was referred to as a wildcat strike, which is like not an entirely legal job action, and it's not necessarily supported by union officials.
Right, it's basically a walkout or a protest that's not supported by everybody that's involved.
Right. This was October 7th, 1969. And according to an article on Medium.com, the fire department decided to join forces with the police for this strike. I'm not sure if they were also facing a pay cut or had asked for a wage increase they didn't get. They may possibly have just been trying to help out their brothers in uniform, put their weight behind it as well. It's not really specified, but on this day, October 7th, the police and the fire department are walking off the job.
A recipe for disaster.
Right. So on that day, a total of 3,700 men in uniform walked off the job, leaving the city, essentially unprotected. Some people said, don't worry about it. People can police themselves. Everything will be okay. I'm not sure exactly how this would play out. Like, I don't know if what happened next would be exactly what would happen everywhere, but I think assuming that people can all police themselves is probably wrong.
I think that the experience that we've been living the last year has shown us that the answer to that is no.
We're not talking, I know there's a lot of talk right now about decommissioning the police force and things like that, and that's not what we're talking about, because if you decommission a police force, there are other things that should come in place to replace it. We're really just talking about not having nothing in place at all and not having planned for it.
The Wild West.
Exactly. The officers left their stations to go and conduct what they were calling a day of study. According to Medium.com, this started at 8 a.m. The first bank robbery happened at 11. By noon, things were starting to go south. Shopkeepers were boarding up their stores to try and stop people from looting. But as the day was going by, things didn't seem to be going as badly as everyone had anticipated. There were attempted bank robberies, and all commerce had essentially shut down because people were scared, but they were coping. It wasn't complete madness. But it seemed like it wasn't complete madness yet. Some people were just waiting for the sun to go down to get the mayhem started.
When you think of all the security features that we have around us at this time in our lives, there's video cameras everywhere, and people, you could trace somebody by pinging your cell phone and all of those things. Back then, there was none of that, or almost.
So around 6 p.m., things really began escalating. There was something else going on in the city that kind of pushed this from just maybe kind of generalized chaos into a more serious situation. So a group of taxi drivers had started gathering together. And the reason that they were gathering is that they were mad that a rival taxi company called Murray Hill Taxi had gotten the exclusive contract of picking people up at the airport. This didn't sit well with them because taxiing people to and from the airport is really a lucrative business. And the rival taxi companies had started a movement called Mouvement de Libération du Taxi, so the taxi liberation movement, essentially. It looks like they kind of seized on the opportunity brought on by the police strike to advance their agenda.
Right, because I guess there was nobody there to respond to calls, so
Yeah.
now's the time. Let's go.
Right. So, and just as a side note, it may sound a little bit funny to have a taxi liberation movement, but it was a really serious organization and they weren't messing around. According to Wikipedia, they had planted bombs in a Murray Hill bus. They had blown up the home of one of the owners of the Murray Hill Taxi Company. They'd made a blockade at the airport. They'd burned some cars. This wasn't their first rodeo.
That's amazing. Like, it's pretty wild stuff for a contract at the airport, but it just goes to show how lucrative it actually was to go to that extent.
And how people, I mean, if you take someone's livelihood away, they don't have anything left. Like they will do what it takes to get it back.
Oh, for sure.
That night, the rival companies were gathering together and they decided to attack a Murray Hill garage. The growing crowd of taxi drivers made their way towards the garage, and obviously they weren't just going to go over for coffee. They had very bad intentions. They were planning to burn the garage down. There were more businesses in the area, including the garage, and as the owners saw the mob approaching, they started arming themselves. This went about the way you would predict it was going to go, which is not well at all. The Sûreté du Québec had been called in earlier in the evening to assist in controlling the city, but they weren't able to control that approaching crowd. They were actually also being stopped by the striking Montreal police officers, according to anacademic.com.
I can understand the Sûreté du Québec being called in, but they must have went in with a little bit of hesitation because they were going against their own.
Right, so it's like the RCMP versus your city police, so they're not necessarily working for the same people, but at the end of the day, they're doing the same job. So I guess it's that same idea as crossing a picket line. It's just not something that's done easily.
Yeah, and I think they can re not refuse to respond. They can hurry up and walk real slow.
They were trying to, I mean, I think they saw the mob coming in and they knew something bad was about to happen, so they were trying to stop them, but they weren't enough people to actually have any control over the group. As the group of men were approaching the garage, someone from the business owner's area started shooting at them. So, turns out the approaching mob was armed as well, so they started firing back. During the chaos, a man who was an off-duty police officer was shot and killed by a sniper. This fighting actually seemed to be the signal everyone was waiting for to sort of just go crazy. So when this fight broke out, the mob started spreading down the streets. They were lighting fires, they were looting. More and more people started joining forces, so the group just kept getting bigger and bigger so that the rioters took over the city.
Well, we've seen it happen in, under different circumstances where you'll have either a mob of kids or a mob of people that are fighting for something that can be considered not that serious. But once things start getting out of control and panic sets in, there's people that have absolutely nothing to do with the situation that just join in for the sake of mayhem.
So at this point, the city's out of control. People are rioting. The streets are being set on fire and looted. And the police aren't responding. So the situation just continues to deteriorate. The National Assembly met in the middle of the night to pass a bill forcing the police officers to go back to work. But at this point, it was basically too late. Things had escalated out of control, and the bill did nothing. It was just a group of people making a decision, and the police just did not listen. They didn't return to work.
I think that was a too little, too late.
Right. The army had to be called in to subdue the rioting crowds. By midnight, the army had been deployed in the streets of Montreal, but it took hours for them to take control of the city, and by that time, a lot of damage had already happened.
And Montreal is a fair-sized city with a lot of different districts and
It was smaller back then. They didn't have all the suburbs, but it's still a pretty large area and was a dense, even then, it was a dense city.
Even at that time was quite a a melting pot of different cultures.
Yeah. So much of the damage had already been done. Less than 20 hours after the police walked off the job, the city was left devastated. Millions of dollars in damage had occurred to local businesses. And this is 1969, millions of dollars, right?
Yeah, it would be a lot more money today.
Exactly. 108 people ended up being arrested. Probably a lot more could have been, but like you said, they didn't have the security cameras, the cell phone information, so trying to figure out who was doing what would have been near impossible unless they were caught red-handed.
Sure, and back then there were still party lines for the telephone.
Right.
So even, communicating with each other was not that easy.
When you say party line, you mean that like more than one person were using the same phone line, right?
Right.
According to the urbansurvivalistsite.com, two people died that night. So there was the officer that we mentioned earlier on, and there was another man who had been breaking into a doctor's house, and he was shot by the homeowner. Six banks had been robbed, and 12 fires had been set. Hundreds of stores were looted, and 40 carloads of glass was shattered from the storefronts. All in all, there was about $3 million in damage.
So I'm surprised that there was not more fires.
I don't know how big the fire had to be counted. You know what I mean? I'm assuming a lot of garbage cans were like, or garbage was set on fire inside a can and things like that, but maybe it had to do a certain amount of damage to actually count it.
Yeah, it could be.
So the aftermath of this was that the police force was disbanded. So they ended up amalgamating Montreal into a larger community, the urban Montreal area. This included suburbs that were extremely well off. So because of this, they actually had more money to put towards the police force. So the police did get the raise, but it was a brand new police force that got it. So that police force was formed and they served the entire now larger community of Montreal. The Murray Hill Limousine Company lost their exclusive rights to airport pickups.
So the police force, by being disbanded, in your information that you found, is there, were the police officers that had gone on strike mostly hired for this new police force?
I really don't know. They didn't mention anything about that, so I'm not sure what happened there. I would guess that at least a certain number of them did. It'd be hard to start a brand new police force from scratch with all new people.
Well, we lived that in our area. I want to say a few years ago, but it's probably been more like 20.
I think I was still in high school when that happened, so yeah, 20-ish.
And I think what happened at that point was it gave the opportunity for the police department to kind of clean the force up.
Yeah.
And the people that they no longer wanted as policemen were just not transferred over to in this case, it was the RCMP.
Right. And I don't know the whole history behind it, but I do know in Montreal there was a lot of things that were run by the mob or that the mob was involved in. And I don't know if that taxi contract was part of that or not, but I do know they had a hand to play in a lot of stuff like that. So, getting a new police force, like you say, it was probably an opportunity to sort of clean things up at least. Or to make things worse, it's hard to say.
Or give the impression that things are being cleaned up.
Right. Anytime I hear about a riot happening, it just makes me think about how close we are at any minute to complete chaos. Like, most of us obey the law, follow rules, listen to what's being said, at least up to a certain extent. But it just takes a couple of people deciding not to really create chaos. I think for most of us, if something like that was happening in our neighborhood, we'd more than likely just barricade ourselves in our house and hope to emerge safely the next morning when things had returned back to normal. But obviously, that's not the case for everyone. Like, people did get involved, people did join in. I like to think that most people would just never participate in something like that, I guess, that people are still good.
Well, I think there's we put so much emphasis on the negative.
Yeah.
I think the majority of people are good people.
Yeah. I mean, look at how many times something's happened and people haven't rioted.
That's true. And how many times that something horrible has happened and people have really pulled together, be it a community that had a terrible tragedy or even a neighborhood where one of the neighbors' houses burned down. Everybody pulls together and does the best they can to help rectify the negative event. So I think deep down inside, people want to be helpful.
So it's funny that we're talking about how communities come together in face of tragedy or difficult events. The moment of kindness that I wanted to talk about is actually from an article that I read on the CBC. It's about a woman from New Brunswick. She was from Rishabakto Village, and about 6 or 7 years ago, she had a child prematurely. So she had her son at 23 weeks. And the article goes on to talk about how the whole community banded around her. Basically, she had to go to Halifax, where her son was in the hospital being taken care of because they had more advanced facilities for him. Her husband was a fisherman, so was often away at sea. She had two other children. Her mother helped like she could with the two other kids, but her mother still worked. There were some local teenagers and some local adults that essentially moved into their house to help with the girls, get them ready for school. They cleaned, they donated meals, they donated time. When the family finally came home, they made sure that nobody was getting close to the child or family members if they were sick, to make sure that her son would stay healthy. So she's very grateful to the whole community. And it's just nice to see how an entire community can get together and help in these situations, how they weren't even asked and they were all participating to help with that family and to make sure a small child's needs were met. And the story ended very well. The baby's 6 years old now, no underlying health condition, and all the help and support the family received helped to raise him into a strong, healthy child. So thanks to everyone who's been listening. We're quickly approaching our one-year anniversary, which I'm really excited about. We're actually just a couple weeks away from it.
That's unbelievable.
Yeah. I do have some fun announcements coming up. I think for our one-year anniversary, I'm going to organize a little giveaway. Nothing major, but there'll be at least one small prize involved. If you're interested in that, you can go to our Instagram page if you haven't joined it yet. So follow us on Instagram. There will be an announcement about a prize giveaway coming in a couple of weeks. You can find us under Crime and Mystery Canada. You can also join our Facebook group, which is Crime and Mystery Canada, or write us at crimeandmysterycanada@gmail.com. As always, have a good night and stay safe out there.
Good night, everybody.